The precautions to be taken here are identical to those you took with the elemental doorways. The card is your entrance and exit from the astral plane. Mark and remember its location within your new environment. I won't go into details of tarot trips. Presumably by this stage you can find them out for yourself. But I might mention that, in my experience, these doorways tend to produce rather more lively visions, in terms of incident, than many others. Chapter 7. The Cabalistic Doorways. The Cabalist goes to work in a different way. He does not attempt to make the mind rise up on the wings of metaphysics into the rarefied air of abstract reality. He formulates a concrete symbol that the eye can see, and lets it represent the abstract reality that no untrained human mind can grasp. Dion Fortune, the mystical Kabbalah. The concrete symbol Dion Fortune mentions is the Tree of Life. Since the turn of the century, this glyph has formed a cornerstone of Western occultism. It was developed out of a set of Hebrew mystical doctrines which, over the centuries, have seduced better minds than yours or mine. As a MCO, philosophical system, the Kabbalah is vast, complex and, thanks to the efforts of modern occultists, continually growing. A man could spend his life in its study and many have. In practical application, part of its broad scope takes in the astral plane. To reach the astral, a Kabbalist will use the tarot trumps, but in a special way. His discipline ensures he will be on familiar ground when he passes through them. He will know, before he starts each trip, how far he wants to go. And he will know when he gets there. His visions are the subject of a tight control and each one is undertaken for a specific purpose. _Understanding any of this requires a grasp of basic principles. To present these fully would take more time and energy than I lave available. But the following outline might get us as far as the doorways. Please inspect Figure 6. This is a diagram of the Tree of Life as it is used in modern esoteric fraternities. It consists of 10 spheres, or sephiroth, DFR 20, two connecting paths between them. Dion Fortune says, this is a concrete symbol representing abstract realities. It represents states and forces and the relationships between them. It is a wiring diagram of the cosmos, and the mind of man. Kabbalists accept the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below. The bedrock structure of the universe thus becomes identical to the bedrock structure of the soul. The forces that play across the vast reaches of interstellar space are parallel to the forces which play within the psyche. Over the years, various associations have been linked with the Sephiroth. Kether, for instance, the topmost sphere of pure, primordial being is associated with light, unity, Parabrahma and the Sahamsara chakra. Malkuth, at the other end of the scale, is associated with matter, the planet Earth, inertia and the elements. Any student taking his first steps in Kabbalism learns the major associations and will usually have lists of the minor ones within easy reach. But if his interest is more than academic, he does not stop there. He adds his personal associations. There is nothing known or unknown which cannot be pigeon-holed into one or other of the 10 spheres. This personal pigeon-holing brings the tree alive. It gives the student at least some grasp of the reality behind the diagram. Since the tree is archetypal, the sephirothic forces are PRF existent in the depths of the psyche. Painstaking meditations, often carried out over a number of years, forge association links of images and ideas which eventually reach down to this bedrock level. Eventually, by triggering the proper switch, the student can make contact with the force of any given sephira. Hence he draws his power. For practical convenience, the sephiroth are often held to represent objective forces, with psychic parallels, while the paths are taken to be subjective states. For present purposes, you can look on these latter as well, marked areas of the astral plane. Top B52, life is a school. We incarnate to learn. Once all the lessons are learnt, we cease to incarnate. We have, over a series of lifetimes, evolved to the state of union with God. We have been absorbed into Kether. We have reached Nirvana. The learning process is rigidly controlled by the law of karma. What we sow, we reap, no more, no less. Normally, hard knocks force us upwards, as pain forces a child to respect fire. But this way is slow. The occultist is impatient. He wants to reach Nirvana quickly. To do so, he makes use of a little, known fact. The fact is this: in karmic terms, physical occurrences do not matter. It is our reaction to them that counts. Since all levels are real, after their own fashion, the Kabbalist attempts to abreact as much of his karma as he can on the astral plane. It is easier to shape than the physical world. On it, within limits, he can choose the initiations he wishes to undertake. And with training, the futural images have just as much potency as any physical experience. The Kabbalist is, at heart, a ritualist. He approaches the door, ways in the manner of a ceremonial magician. Sometimes he will go so far as to build a physical environment that makes the job easier. In his temple or his lodge, he will set up the symbols as a focus for his mind. But ultimately this is not necessary. The important temple is built up, by will and imagination, on the astral plane. Before disgusting Kabbalists amongst my readers with this ridiculously abbreviated outline of their vast system, I will now move on to its severely practical application so far as the astral plane is concerned. Path workings are normally undertaken in company. And at least one member of the group should have had Kabbalistic training. There is a good reason for this. Unless your trip is going to turn into an aimless wandering, someone has to read the signposts. And the only one who knows the symbol language is a Kabbalist. Let us suppose you wish to tread the 22nd path. Reference to the Kabbalistic books shows this path runs between the spheres of Malkuth and Yesod. Malkuth represents, among other things, the physical universe. Yesod is the all, embracing sphere of the astral plane. The proper exit from Malkuth must be via a temple incorporating the major symbols of this sephira. Minimum needs for your experiment are a tarot deck, a small table and a lighted candle. It is as well to open the proceedings with some form of ritual. The banishing ritual of the pentagram, outlined in an earlier chapter, is ideal. Switch out all other lights before lighting the candle. Group members should be seated comfortably around the table with the candle flame as focus of attention. This produces a mild hypnotic effect and makes concentration easier for those untrained to it. The tarot card associated with the 22nd path is trump number 21, the universe. Pass it round beforehand and make sure everyone is familiar with how it looks. It might be as well to explain that details in the cards vary from pack to pack. Part of the operation requires description of the card and it is important that nothing should jar concentration. With the candle lighted and members of the group sitting comfortably, the Kabbalist should take over as leader of the expedition. His first job is to paint a vivid verbal picture of the Mafuth temple. As he talks, in a soft, but emphatic tone, the remaining travelers must attempt to build a picture in their minds. This again should be done as vividly as possible, with as much detail as possible, so that the impression of actually sitting in the temple is built up. You will probably find visualization easier in the group context than alone. This is partially due to the stimulus of THL spoken description and partially due to the darkened room. There is too the possibility of a telepathic undercurrent. The pictures held in individual minds seem to reinforce each other. It is vital that the temple is described in such a way that the description helps visualization. This rules out any question of a cool, clinical approach. The tone should be persuasive, the language full of image and color. At the outset, the temple must be strongly linked with the room in which you are sitting for the Malkuth temple. The description might run along these lines: make yourselves comfortable and please try to relax. There is nothing that need worry you. We are about to embark on an experimental trip to the astral plane. Your reactions may vary. Some of you will have a vivid mental experience. A few of you may even feel you have passed into a different physical dimension. This is an illusion, although it may seem very real. But don't worry if it happens. It simply means that your physical and psychic make-up allows you to lose touch temporarily with the physical plane. In a moment, I am going to describe a temple. I want you to follow this description and visualize the temple as clearly as you possibly can. I will speak slowly to allow you time for this. Stay relaxed and do the best you can, for there is plenty of time. Soon after we have built the temple in our minds, we will pass th rough a doorway onto the astral plane. When this happens, I would ask you all to stay together. And please remember to stay together as our journey continues. This is quite important. Now, together, we must begin to build our temple. This is the temple of Malkuth, the Kabbalistic Sephira of the physical plane reverse. We are already quite familiar with this plane of operation. We live and work with matter every day. This room is a part of Malkuth and this room will become our starting point. But first we must change it slightly. We will do so by an act of imagination. All of us must take part in this act of imagination, for there is no ultimate reality outside the mind. By visualizing the temple as I describe it, we are agreeing what, for the moment, we will see. For the purposes of our trip, we are making it so. Look towards the candle flame, and as you look, the room is changing. Slowly it becomes a temple, a holy place in contact with the inner planes. Already in your minds, you begin to see this change. The walls of the room are shifting, disappearing, changing. In their place appears a colonnade of pillars. Strong, black marble pillars, flecked with gold and highly polished. Top B55. Visualize them strongly, hold the picture in your mind until you feel they are really there. And so they are, those pillars have existence in your mind. And now the floor beneath your feet is changing. Please stay quite relaxed and visualize these things strongly. Beneath your feet you now feel the temple floor. Now it is as if you were standing on some vast chess board, for the floor beneath your feet has taken on a regular arrangement of squares, black squares alternating with the white and chessboard pattern. This is the floor of the temple of Malkuth and we stand on it now, surrounded by the polished marble pillars. Shut your eyes now, if you find that easier. Continue to visualize swungly. The candle flame has left an after image. This helps you see it clearly in your mind. Now the table which supports the kalk has become an altar. The construction of the altar is a double cube, one set on the other. This double cube is the altar of Malkuth, the three-dimensional universe of matter. Visualize it strongly, draped in black. Look now, with your mind's eye, into the candle flame. In it you can see a figure, growing steadily until he towers above you, reaching almost to the roof. This vast figure is Sandalphon, Fush Angel of Earth and Guardian of the Temple of Malkuth. He is dressed in robes of olive, citrine, russet and black, the colors you might see on an apple in the autumn. These are the symbolic colors of Malkuth. Look beyond the figure and the altar to the east. There you see RNC3 doorways. Notice in particular the middle doorway. Draped over it is a curtain. And on the curtain is a representation of the card you saw before, the 21st tarot trump, called the universe. Fu you watch, the Fush Angel Sandalphon leaves the Allah and moves towards the east. Now he indicates towards the doorway and we approach closer as a group. Visualize strongly now, for we are approaching the doorway and nearing the first steps of our journey on the card you saw. The outline of the card was given. I will now fill in the details and as I do so, please try to visualize each one strongly. The veil draped on the door shows a huge laurel wreath, oval in shape and intertwined with flowers, lilies and roses. Outside the wreath, one at each corner, are the elemental representations, a man, an eagle, a lion and a bull. Inside the wreath is a deep, dark, liquid area, indigo black in hue. Stare into this dark oval and watch carefully. As you watch, a figure floats towards you, growing larger until it almost fills the laurel frame. Now you can see it as a pale, near, nude hermaphrodite, slim and graceful, standing within the laurel wreath. In one hand it holds a golden spiral. In the other, a spiral of silver. Draped around it is a flowing scarf of bright blue. The figure signs to us and we move towards the oval pool. All that remains at this stage is to establish a marching order which should be maintained throughout the trip. As the party steps into the symbol, both Sandalphon and the hermaphrodite figure remain behind. A trained Qabbalist will recognize the various symbols which arise on the trip. These he uses as a guide to establish whether the party remains on the right path. If, for instance, he should find Hamif faced with an animal associated with some other Fath, he is immediately warned that something has gone wrong. There are also set symbols marking the center point and ending of the path. Ear all astral Ainis, the return trip must rewise the outgoing path. Results of path workings, properly conducted, are usually very interesting. Gareth Knight reports a case of clairvoyance developed by this man's. My own experience, over a brief series of workings, was that there appeared a sudden tendency to change in the lives of those taking part. This may, of course, be sheer coincidence. But it is the sort of coincidence the occultist expects. To him it is evidence of the psychic parallelism Jung called synchronicity. So far I have sized the dangers of astral journeys. As a balance, I might conclude this chapter with the brief comment of a novice immediately after his first path working. I feel marvelous, he said. That was a most therapeutic experience. This was on p58. Chapter 8 The Oriental Doorways. There was also more to the I Ching than met my eye when I started using it. The book is Chinese and older in origin than even our mysterious. Its doctrines predate Confucianism and Taoism and influence the development of both. For millenniums the I Ching, or Book of Changes, has been used throughout China as an oracle. This is not quite the same as saying it was used for fortune telling. Although its usage may have grown degenerate at times, the importance of the work is its curious ability to interpret the meaning of the moment and offer wise counsel from this basis. In his foreword to the English language edition of Richard Wilhelm's translation, the psychologist Carl Jung puts forward some interesting ideas about why the book works. He sees a connection between the mechanics of the oracle and synchronistic phenomena. The Chinese, who used the book for centuries, were less sophisticated. Their tradition held that spiritual agencies were involved. They approached the book with reverence, as though it were a person. And as a person the book replied. Souls. Both Jung and the Chinese sages got results. Viewpoint appears to be quite unimportant. To work the oracle, 3 coins or 50 yarrow sticks are needed. Either can be used to build up hexagrams, based on the ancient Oriental principle of the yin and the yang. The yin and yang are the 2 great complementary aspects of creation, the negative and positive, the female and the male, the dark and the light. The coin oracle, which is the easier to use, works like this dash. You formulate your question and, for preference, write it down. Then you toss the coins and note whether they come down dot heads or tails. A head counts as a yin and carries the value 2. Tails are yang and represent a 3. Add up the 3 values to produce a underscore lotal. This will obviously be 6 to 3 yins, 9, 3 yangs, 7, or 8. Not more from this chapter here. Chapter 9, Hypnosis and the Astral. Although not a doorway in the strict sense of the term, hypnosis is a major key to the astral plane. Whether used alone, or in conjunction with one of the doorways mentioned previously, it can produce striking results. But it is one big drawback. Not everyone can be hypnotized. For useful work on the astral plane, your subject must reach medium, and for preference should reach deep, trance level. This cuts potential chaperation by more than half. About 25% of subjects are capable of reaching medium level trance. Only 20% will reach deep trance. As far as I can see, the only way of finding that fruitful 20% is by trial and error. Even if a subject can reach deep trance, your problems are not over. He may not be interested in futile experiments. Worse still, he may be so interested that his mind will throw up all sorts of lunatic occult fantasies to confuse the picture. In 2 years of consistent experiment, I found only 4 really useful subjects, and considered myself lucky at that. One was a company director named Arthur Gibson. One was a shop assistant named Denise Alexander. One was a merchant seaman named Sam Gordon. And the 4th, already mentioned in this book, was B. Van Vliet. With these 4, it became obvious that the astral plane extends beyond the bounds of common sense. In the days of Mesmer, it was generally thought hypnosis was induced by some subtle influence emanating from the hypnotist. Today, it seems much more likely that the subject really does the trick. Horror stories apart, nobody is hypnotized against his will. He is first taught briefly how to relax, then taught how to sink into trance. The process is reinforced by suggestion, and the hypnotist's personality plays an important part. But even here, it is the subject's reaction to the hypnotist, his confidence in the hypnotist's ability and integrity, that makes the real difference between success and failure. This means that, potentially, anyone can become a hypnotist. Your only real problem is convincing others that you know what you are doing. There are some dangers in hypnosis, but these have generally been overstated. If you begin to practice the art, you will be asked, time out of number, what happens if you can't wake me up? The answer is, put you to bed. Left alone, subjects in trance tend to pass eventually into normal sleep and wake up naturally a few hours later. It may be reassuring to know that only once have I had any difficulty in waking a subject, and even here total alertness was delayed less than half a minute. A very real danger does exist when it comes to making suggestions to a subject. These have a tendency to stick longer than you might like. A textbook example is the case of a man who sought psychiatric help because of a persistent feeling he was being followed. In probing the man's background, the psychiatrist found he had recently been hypnotized. During trance, the suggestion was given that he was being chased by a savage dog. The subject reacted positively and showed every sign of fright. But the suggestion was never countermanded. When the subject awoke, he forgot the hypnotic experience. The original suggestion, however, remained in his unconscious mind and subsequently came out in the form of his obsession. In view of this, a prime rule of hypnosis is never to implant a suggestion without afterwards cancelling it completely. This rule holds good even when there is no apparent response to the original suggestion. Another rule I learned the hard way is to frame suggestions in a positive manner. In my early experiments, I caused one subject considerable discomfort by suggesting she would have no headache when she woke. Her mind missed the little word no and she woke in considerable pain. There is one further pseudo-danger, which leads me to suggest a final rule: never attempt to hypnotize anyone who suffers from a heart disease. There is nothing in the trance experience to harm the heart, or any other organ for that matter. But if, by coincidence, your subject should have a heart attack during trance, you will have a difficult time convincing his relatives you are not a murderer. It may be unfortunate that hypnosis is still a public mystery, but it is something you must learn to appreciate. There are a variety of methods for inducing trance. One technique I have found generally suitable goes as follows: settle your subject in a comfortable armchair and seat yourself beside him. Spend a few minutes chatting to him about hypnosis generally and what is going to happen in particular. It is important that he is completely at ease about the operation, so encourage questions and answer them frankly and honestly. Explain that you can do nothing without his full cooperation. This means that, ultimately, he is in charge of what goes on. He can stop the process at any time. With the preliminaries over, your next job is to make sure the subject is completely relaxed. This is not so easy as it sounds. The pace of modern life has helped make most of us quite unconscious of the variety of muscular tensions we carry round every day. By far the most successful method of getting rid of these tensions is systematic relaxation. And before relaxation can be achieved, your subject must be made fully conscious of how tension feels in individual muscles. Begin with his feet. Ask him to curl his toes as tightly as he can manage and to hold them in this position as long as possible. Very quickly this will produce an uncomfortable, cramped feeling. When this arises, tell him to let his toes go limp. In this way, he becomes immediately aware of the difference between tension and relaxation in a particular set of muscles. Now move on to his calf muscles and repeat the process. Continue up the body, thighs, stomach, hands, arms, shoulders, neck, alternately tensing and relaxing. When it comes to the face, have him grimace, tensing the muscles beneath the skin and gritting his teeth tightly. Have him hold this, then relax. He should pay particular attention to the jaw muscles, which often prove resistant to letting go. The final area, easily overlooked, is the forehead and scalp. A severe frown is usually enough to tense this whole area. Then have him let it go. If your subject is unused to systematic relaxation, involuntary tensions may well have crept in again by the end of the process. So have him mentally go over his body in the same sequence as before, relaxing any set of muscles he finds has again become tense. It may even be necessary to repeat this process more than once until complete relaxation is achieved. At this stage you are ready for the tranquil-inducing process. Have your subject fix his eyes on some spot above his normal line of vision. Then begin to talk. What you say is, in effect, a series of repeated suggestions, one built on the other. You will learn to judge trance levels from the subject's reactions, and there are simple tests you can apply to check your accuracy. Keep your V.I slow and soothing, but make sure the words are clear. Try not to stumble, GR pause too long in the early stages. Speak reasonably slowly. You may find that your words fall into a rhythm, and this is all to the good. Your first positive suggestion is a confidence builder and involves slight cheating. The suggestion is that his eyes are becoming tired and heavy. What very few of your subjects will realize is that tired eyes and heavy eyelids are a perfectly natural physical result of directing the gaze upwards for any length of time. A further suggestion that his whole body feels heavy is based on a similar situation. When your body is totally relaxed, it does feel heavy as a natural consequence. And so it should. Few of your subjects will weigh less than 7 stones. One thing to watch out for at this point is any suggestion which might produce a jarring psychological effect. A woman with fat legs, for instance, will not take kindly to being told her legs are growing heavy. She is only too painfully aware that she has heavy legs at the best of times. Your total sequence of suggestion, up to deep trance level, might go something like this: please breathe deep and relax. Deep breathing helps you to relax, so breathe deep now and relax. Keep your eyes fixed on that point and relax. Deeply relaxed. And as you breathe deep and relax, your body grows heavy. You can feel your body heavy because you're deeply relaxed. Deeply relaxed. Breathing deep and relaxed. You can feel your body heavy because you're so very deeply relaxed. Breathe deep and relax and listen to my voice. As you listen to my voice, breathing deeply and relaxed, your eyes grow tired and your eyelids become heavy. As you listen to my voice, your eyelids become heavy and your eyes grow tired, so very tired as you listen to my voice. You can feel your eyelids heavy. You can feel your eyes grow tired as you listen to my voice. So very tired as you listen to my voice. So very heavy as you listen to my voice. Apostrophe. At this point, the first visible sign will emerge in a flickering of the subject's eyelids. Quite frequently the eyes will actually slide slowly shut. These are positive signs, but do not become too excited about them. Except in very rare cases, your subject is still very far from trance. About 85% of all subjects will react in this way. The percentage who will go deeper is a lot smaller. But despite all eyes, watch out for the signs. Because it is on the basis of these first reactions that any deepening of trance is built. Your subject has found that your first suggestions worked. Consequently he will, or rather his unconscious mind will, more easily accept your next suggestion. Down page 69. Resist the temptation to go too fast, even with a good subject. Short-circuiting the process may make things easier for you, but you run the risk of trying a suggestion the subject is not yet ready to accept. His failure to react tends to shoot the whole operation back to the beginning. Now continue the sequence. Let your eyelids close as you listen to my voice. You can let your eyelids close because your eyes are tired and sleepy. So very sleepy, sleepy and relaxed. You're feeling so sleepy, sleepy and relaxed as you listen to my voice. Breathe deep and relax as you listen to my voice. You're falling asleep as you listen to my voice. deeply asleep as you listen to my voice. Continue suggestions of this type for a few minutes, telling the subject that he is becoming more and more deeply relaxed, falling deeper and deeper asleep.